money on the basis that we had a breakthrough plastic that was a step beyond GE's first engineered plastic, Lexan, which had just set a new performance standard. It was a hard sell, in part because we didn't want to move to Mount Vernon, Indiana, where our first Lexan plastics plant had been built. Instead, we picked a 450-acre site in Selkirk, New York. I found it on a Sunday afternoon drive over from Pittsfield with my wife and three kids in the car. The five of us got out and walked all over the site. It was a beautiful piece of land, a former marshaling yard for the New York Central Railroad, with a right-of-way on the Hudson River. I loved the site and wouldn't leave until the kids gave out. Some GE executives were skeptical of the location because it was only 30 miles away from Schenectady, where GE already had one of our largest and oldest manufacturing plants. There was a lot of selfishness in our request, too. We wanted to run our own show and stay where we were. To justify it, we argued that we were creating a highly technical product and needed access to the chemists and scientists in GE's R&D center in Schenectady, as well as our own research lab in Pittsfield, some 50 miles away. We won the argument and the money. By this time, Bob Finhold's more creative bent earned him a promotion to strategic planning at headquarters. With the general manager's slot open, I went after it. After a dinner in Selkirk with Gutoff and the rest of our team, I followed Gutoff to his car behind the Stone Ends restaurant and jumped into the front seat of his Volkswagen convertible. "Why not me for Bob's job?" I said. "Are you kidding?" Gutoff asked. "Jack, you don't know anything about marketing. That's what this new product introduction is all about." I wouldn't take no for an answer. I stayed in Gutoff's car on that dark and cold evening for well over an hour, pounding him with my qualifications for the job, thin as they might be. It was my turn to sell Gutoff and sell him hard. I reminded him of the time when he sold me on staying at GE. He didn't give me an answer that night, but when we drove out of that parking lot, Gutoff knew how badly I wanted the job. Over the next 7 days or so, I called him with additional arguments to bolster my case. Within a week, he called and asked me to come down to his office in Bridgeport. "USOB," he said, "you convinced me to give you the job, and I'm going to do it. You better deliver." I went back to Pittsfield that day as the new general manager of the polymer products operation. I didn't have long to celebrate. Just after getting the new job and breaking ground on the site, we found out that our PPO product had a serious flaw. Aging tests began to show that over time it became brittle and cracked under the high temperatures it was designed to withstand. There was just no way that it would make it as a replacement for hot water copper pipes, one of its biggest potential markets. I had lobbied myself into a potentially career-killing challenge. There is a moment forever frozen into my memory. I was standing at the Selkirk site on a cold winter day in 1965 with Gutoff and Alan Hay, the bowtie GE corporate research lab scientist who invented PPO. In our overcoats and gloves, we stood at the top of a massive hole in the ground that must have been 30 feet deep, enough to bury all of us. With the product's newly found technical flaws and the gaping hole in front of us, my GE career flashed before me. "Al, you've got to help us fix this thing, or we're all dead," I said. Hay turned to us and replied calmly, "Hey guys, don't worry about it. I have a couple of new plastics coming along." I felt like throwing him in the hole. I wondered what I had gotten myself into. We were way ahead of ourselves. This was a $10 million investment in a business that the company didn't really understand. Now it became clear we didn't have a working product for the plant to produce. Even worse, the scientist who invented the product had no idea how to fix it. It took 6 frantic months before we worked our way out of the problem. I practically lived in the lab during that time. We tried everything. We were sticking every compound we could think of into PPO to see if it would stop the cracking. Dan Fox, the chemist who convinced me to join GE, led a team of chemists in Pittsfield who eventually found the solution by blending PPO with low-cost polystyrene and some rubber. We had to juggle the plant design to take care of the blending process, but it worked. The story had a happy ending. The blended plastic was called Noril and eventually became a winning product that today does more than $1 billion in worldwide sales. What made it work was a crazy band of people who believed we could do almost anything. We were scared to death, but filled with dreams and just nuts enough to try anything to get the plastic to work. We may have been in one of the world's largest corporations, but in Pittsfield or Selkirk, we saw ourselves as a very small family business with a bank behind us. Talk about luck. This whole experience in the plastic business was like God coming down and saying, "Jack, this is your moment. Take it." I was still pretty new at this. I can remember the first time a salesman took Carolyn and me to dinner. I thought that was big stuff. I was a project manager and bought raw materials from his company, Pittsburgh Consolidated Coal. He took us out for drinks and dinner at the Mill on the Floss, the best restaurant in the area, and it was free. It might seem naive today, but everything was a new experience. I loved every minute of it, and I found pleasure in the smallest things. We used to fly a two-engine United Caravelle jet from Hartford, Connecticut to Chicago on our way to the plastics plant that made Lexan in Mount Vernon, Indiana. On every trip, the stewardess would hand each of us a can of macadamia nuts and two tiny bottles of scotch. We'd look forward to that treat all the way to the airport. At times, I couldn't believe that I was being paid to do all these things. Neither could my mother. When I traveled to Europe for the first time in 1964 on a business trip, she was petrified that GE might not reimburse me. "Are you sure they're going to pay you for it?" she asked. All these new experiences were part of growing a business from scratch, and we made just about every one of them an excuse for celebration. When we landed an order of $500 for plastic pellets, we'd stop off for beers on the way home to celebrate. We posted the names of every customer who bought $500 or more on the wall in what we called our 500 Club. Whenever we'd add 10 new customers to the club, it was time for another party. Beer kegs and pizza parties were standard practice in Silicon Valley, but they were also standard for Selkirk and Pittsfield in the mid-1960s. Every early promotion, every bonus, and every raise were also cause for celebration. When I got a $3,000 bonus in 1964, I threw a party for all the employees at the new house we had just purchased on Cambridge Avenue, a working-class area of Pittsfield. The very next Monday, I treated myself to my first convertible, a greenish Pontiac Le Mans. Boy, was I feeling on top of the world. But I'd quickly get a reminder of how things can change. Besides the car, I also bought a new suit. I liked to differentiate myself from the rest of the pack in those early days. In the summer, I would often wear tan poplin suits made by Haspel, with blue button-down shirts and striped ties. Silly as it now seems, I even liked the ring of hearing someone address me as Dr. Welch. After work on one beautiful spring day, I went to the parking lot and got into my shiny new car. I pushed the lever to put the top down for the first time. All of a sudden, the hydraulic hose sprang a leak. Dark, grungy oil shot up onto my suit and ruined the paint job on the front of my beautiful new car. I couldn't believe it. There I was, thinking I was bigger than life, and smack came the reminder that brought me back to reality. It was a great lesson. Just when you think you're a big shot, something happens to wake you up. It would by no means be the last time this would happen. Even so, the family business continued to grow, and so did I. Once we had the Selkirk plant up and began selling Noril, sales took off. We grew rapidly from 1965 to 1968, and then I got the next big break. In early June of 1968, nearly 8 years after joining GE, I was promoted to general manager of the $26 million plastics business. This was a big deal, making me, at 32, the company's youngest general manager. The move put me into the big leagues with all the trimmings, an annual invitation to the company's top management meeting every January in Florida, and my first stock options. I was on my way. Chapter 4. Flying Below the Radar. Life appeared to be perfect. There was only one regret. I could no longer share my success with my parents. My mother had died on January 25, 1965, which was the saddest day of my life. She was only 66 years old, but had been suffering from heart trouble for many years. I had been an undergraduate at UMass in Amherst when she had her first heart attack. I was so upset then that after my aunt called with the news, I literally rushed out of the dorm and began running down the highway to Salem, about 110 miles away. I was too filled with emotion to stand and wait by the side of the road as I was thumbing a ride back home. After a 3-week stay in the hospital, she went home, rested, and recovered. This was all before beta blockers and bypass surgery. They would save my own life years later. She suffered another heart attack 3 years later and went through the same routine. 3 years after that, she had her third and final one. She and my father were in Florida on vacation at the time. I had given them $1,000 out of my bonus that year to help them escape a tough New England winter. That money meant a lot to both of us. When I handed it to her, she burst with pride. She had always provided me with everything I had from the day I was born. My modest $1,000 gift was a chance to finally give her something in return. To her, it reflected the success her product was enjoying. She was so proud of me. Thank God I did it. One of my life's great regrets is not being able to give her all the things I could if she were alive today. When my father told me that my mother was in Fort Lauderdale Hospital, I immediately flew down from Pittsfield and went straight to her room. She was in bad shape, weak and frail. The night she died, I remember sitting with her when she asked me to wash her back. I sponged her back clean with warm water and soap, and she was so happy I would do that. Afterward, my dad and I returned to the one-bedroom efficiency motel where they had been staying. We never saw her alive again. I was devastated. My father and aunt returned to Salem by train with my mother's body while I drove my dad's car back home. I drove north all night long. I stopped for some rest at a highway motel in North Carolina, but stayed there for only 4 hours, tossing and turning. I was so restless and so angry. I cried and kicked the car the whole way. I felt cheated, angry, and mad at God for taking my mother from me. By the time I got home, I had cried myself out. The wake and funeral at St. Thomas the Apostle Church were really a celebration of her life. At a funeral parlor in Salem, all our relatives, neighbors, and hundreds of friends I didn't know showed up, each with a story my mother told about her son, Jackie. Inevitably, every story she bored her friends with spoke of her pride in me. My father also took her death hard. He was a good and generous man. He had bought me a new car when he couldn't afford it. His job and my mother's overwhelming personality kept him from having much of an impact on my life, but I loved him. Now it was so sad to see him refuse to adjust to life without her. Without my mother, he was a lost soldier. She had kept him on a strict salt-free diet because he was suffering from edema. Now he became indifferent about what he ate. Soon the water retention made his face puffy and he began to gain weight. He just ate himself to death with the wrong foods. He retained so much water that he was put in the hospital. I rushed back from a business trip in Europe. He was alive when I walked into the hospital elevator to get to his floor. By the time I reached his bedside, he had died. Just 15 months after my mother's death, on April 22, 1966, my father passed away. He was 71 years old. I was thrown for a loop. My mother and father were gone, and I was feeling awfully sorry for myself. I was lucky to have my wife Carolyn there to pick up the pieces. She was strong, quick-witted, and always supportive. She reminded me how lucky I was to have a great family with 3 healthy kids, Kathy, John, and Anne. Mark would come later, in April of 1968. She was a real rock for me, not only then, but on many other occasions. When I worried about the consequences of rocking the boat at work, Carolyn would encourage me to do exactly what I thought was right, regardless of what others at GE might think. After each promotion, she and the kids would celebrate by decorating the house and driveway with colorful streamers. Following my promotion to General Manager of Plastics, I had a 1969 interview with the Monogram, the company magazine. When the writer came out to Pittsfield for our interview, he referred to me as Dr. Welch. I shot back, "I don't make house calls, so call me Jack," a quote he included in the article. I was now ready to act as a businessman and not an engineer, so I was anxious to bag the Dr. Welch moniker. I bragged that my employees were a turned-on bunch who generated their own electricity. I boasted that we grew the plastics business more in my first year as general manager than in the previous 10 years. There's gold here, and we were lucky enough to come along and dig the mine. What a nass I was, so completely full of myself. Without regard for any of the previous leaders of the business, I claimed we would break all the sales and profit records. Those who read the article must have damn near choked. Fortunately, I was below the radar, insulated from the GE bureaucracy. When I got the entire plastics operation, which included Lexan, I really believed I had inherited gold. Compared to Noril, Lexan was a thoroughbred. It was clear as glass and tough as steel. It was flame-resistant and lightweight. Boeing put 4,000 pounds of Lexan into every 747 jumbo jet it made in those days. Half of its applications replaced metal. For years, we had been selling a blended product in Noril, and we were always trying to get it to work. We were the second-class citizens with the second-class product. With a lower selling price, we managed to get it into business machine housings, lawn sprinklers, hair dryers, disposable razor cartridges, and color televisions. But we had to fight for every 500-pound order. When we finally got Lexan, I thought we could take on the world and was cocky enough to say so. The statement was even more outrageous since the company's view of plastics was a lot less flattering. The guy who had been running the business was promoted to general manager of silicones, then about 50% larger than plastics. Silicones was very profitable, while plastics was just getting to break even. Nevertheless, the future looked very bright. This was a time when forecasters believed that plastics would be the fastest-growing industry over the next decade, faster than computers and electronics. Even the movies were getting into it. In The Graduate, Dustin Hoffman was encouraged to get a career in plastics. We added marketing people and began promoting the plastics business as if it were Tide detergent. We hired St. Louis Cardinal pitcher Bob Gibson to be in our ads. We filmed a TV commercial with a bull in a china shop, except all the china made from Lexan plastic didn't break when the bull wreaked havoc on the set. We hired radio comedians Bob and Ray to plug our plastics in Detroit during prime time. We'd air the radio spots between 7:30 and 8 a.m. when our target customers, the automotive engineers, were stuck in traffic jams on their way to their General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler offices. We had billboards promoting Lexan on all the roads leading to work. Denny McClain, at that time a 30-game winner with the Detroit Tigers, hurled fastballs at me while I was holding up a Lexan plastic sheet in the parking lot of our Detroit office. The local press covered the event. All this promotion got a lot of attention because it was really different marketing for an industrial plastic. We wanted to replace every metal part in a car with Lexan, from the trim on the dashboard to the crank handles on the windows. Because our 5-person office in Detroit was competing against DuPont's 40-person office, we had to be faster and more creative. We took on the big chemical companies and did well because we could outrun them. We were using the strength of a big company and trying to run with the speed of a small company. We were flying. By 1970, we had beaten my boastful predictions by more than doubling the plastics business in less than 3 years. Despite the obvious success, I was clearly ruffling the feathers of some powerful people at corporate headquarters. One of them was Roy Johnson, the head of GE's Human Resources Department. Johnson was the keeper of the keys, reporting directly to Chairman Fred Borch at the time and eventually to Reg Jones, and he had a big impact on hiring decisions. Years later, I found a memo that Johnson wrote in July 1971 to Vice Chairman Herm Weiss. At the time, I was being considered for another promotion to Vice President of the Chemical and Metallurgical Division, a $400 million group of businesses. In the memo, Johnson concluded that I deserved the promotion, but that the appointment carries with it more than the usual degree of risk. Despite his many strengths, Jack has a number of significant limitations. On the plus side, he has a driving motivation to grow a business, natural entrepreneurial instincts, creativeness, and aggressiveness, is a natural leader and organizer, and has a high degree of technical competence. On the other hand, continued Johnson, he is somewhat arrogant, reacts or overreacts emotionally, particularly to criticism, gets too personally involved in the details of his business, tends to over-rely on his quick mind and intuition rather than on solid homework and staff assistance in getting into and out of complex situations, and has something of an anti-establishment attitude toward General Electric activities outside his own sphere. I'm glad I found this evaluation later, or I might have done something stupid, even if he had some pretty good points. At the time, I probably wouldn't have accepted the criticism. Johnson chalked up my limitations to youthfulness and lack of maturity, but fortunately didn't block me for the division job. Thank goodness Herm Weiss supported me. Looking back, there were enough reasons for Johnson and others to have reservations. Obviously, I wasn't a natural fit for the corporation. I had little respect or tolerance for protocol. I was an impatient manager, especially with people who didn't perform. I was blunt and candid, and some thought rude. My language could be coarse and impolitic. I didn't like sitting and listening to canned presentations or reading reports, preferring one-on-one conversations where I expected managers to know their businesses and to have the answers. I loved constructive conflict and thought open and honest debates about business issues brought out the best decisions. If an idea couldn't survive a no-holds-barred discussion, the marketplace would kill it. Larry Bossidy, a good friend and former GE vice chairman, would later liken our staff meetings to Miller Lite commercials. They were loud, raucous, and animated. And I never hid my thoughts or feelings. During a business discussion, I could get so emotionally involved that I'd stammer out what others might consider outrageous things. A couple of favorites were, "My 6-year-old kid could do better than that," or "Don't Walter Cronkite me." That was understood by everyone to mean, you report the bad news, but you don't tell me how you're going to fix it. People who couldn't fit into this informal and entrepreneurial environment left or were asked to leave. I cut my losses quickly on bad hires that didn't perform. People who were arrogant or pompous didn't last very long. Those who delivered took home outsized salary increases and bonuses just as I now did. I kicked, but I also hugged. These differences cast me as a rebel of sorts and led to all kinds of ridiculous scuttlebutt. Most of the rumors about me were just that, rumors. They made for some fun conversations around the water cooler, but had little basis in reality. The gossips claimed that I'd jump on top of desks or conference tables like some kind of temperamental bully. That was a crock. Yet I kept moving higher. Despite Johnson's reservations, I got the job as head of the Chemical and Metallurgical Division in 1971, and it brought a bunch of new challenges. I had spent 11 years in GE working in the plastics arena. Now I had to figure out how to run a whole portfolio of materials businesses, including carbide cutting tools, industrial diamonds, insulating materials, and electromaterials products, and do it all with very different people. My first job was to get a close look at my team. With a couple of exceptions, I found them wanting. I'm the first to admit I could be impulsive in removing people during those early days. But over the years, I learned a lot about how to do it. It's the toughest and most difficult thing we ever do. It's never easy, and it doesn't ever become easier. If I learned anything about making this easier, it's seeing to it that no one should ever be surprised when they are asked to leave. By the time I met with managers I was about to replace, I would have had at least 2 or 3 conversations to express my disappointment and to give them the chance to turn things around. I would follow up every business review with a handwritten note. Some may not have appreciated my candor, but they always knew exactly where they stood. That first talk is when the surprise and disappointment, if any, should occur, not when the person is asked to leave. I can't remember a single instance where someone felt shocked or blindsided when our final conversation took place. "Look," I'd say, "we gave this thing a good run. We both know it's not working out. It's time to wrap it up." Inevitably, there's some disappointment. More often than not, there's relief. When it's time for the final conversation, the subject quickly gets to, what's my deal? I've been lucky enough all my life to work for a company with the financial resources to be able to soften the blow. At that point, the biggest challenge is to get everyone focused on the future. Assure them that this is another transition in their life when they can make a new start, just like the transition from high school to college or from college to the first job. They can move on to another environment where all past warts are forgotten. I've seen many people go on to better and happier lives after leaving jobs that just weren't working. All of us have a responsibility to try to make that happen. I eventually had to deliver the bad news to three of the executives who reported to me in the new job in 1971. I also had a few keepers. I replaced myself in plastics with Tom Fitzgerald, a wild Irishman. Most of us in plastics were engineers. Tom was the only true peddler. He and I were great friends, as well as business soulmates. I took out the manager of our silicones business and found someone from my past, Walt Robb, the PhD research engineer who recruited me at Illinois. Walt had already moved out of the lab and into an operating role as head of a small medical development business. Into our laminating business, where I replaced the manager, I put Chuck Carson, an associate from plastics, who had been my finance chief and later head of our Lexan sheet business. Laminates was a difficult business. Our major competitor, American Cyanamid's Formica brand, dominated the market and overwhelmed our brand, Textolite. We had the weakest distributors. Chuck was as strong as they make them. He was so tough, we called him Frank Nitti, after the rough guy on The Untouchables, a popular TV show at the time. Chuck always made the numbers and the budget, but couldn't do much to improve the business's low margins or weak competitive position. He and I tried everything to make a silk purse out of this sow's ear. It was the first time I saw the sadness in people grinding it out in a lousy business, going head-to-head with a nearly invincible competitor with little hope of making it better. Until then, I thought all businesses could be exciting. I believed that if you poured research and money into things, new products came, and with them, future growth and success. It was my first look at the real world of bad businesses, a lesson that over my career would come to have an enormous impact. Luckily, though, our other businesses had pretty good margins, especially plastics, the real driver of growth. I dove in to understand the people in these new businesses. In our metallurgical business in Detroit, for example, I asked to see the sales management team during an early human resources review. I could not believe the quality of the team. They came in with dull, formal presentations. They had no passion for their jobs and couldn't answer the most routine questions. I considered them the ultimate milk-run sales force, salesmen who couldn't find new accounts to save their lives. After the review, two managers were removed, but I met one special guy, John Opie, then market development manager. He was 35 years old and had been in the business for a dozen years. I gave him the first of many battlefield promotions, making him national sales manager the day I met him. After having seen all his new regional sales managers, I told Opie that if I were him, I'd ask all six of them to leave over the next year. Eventually, five did. That was obviously out of the ordinary, far out of the ordinary, but it jolted the team and Opie used it to energize the business. Hardworking and totally unselfish, Opie would go on to become one of GE's best operating executives, ending up as one of my vice chairmen. I didn't go out of my way to thumb my nose at the bureaucracy, but I was different and threatening to some of the headquarters people. Roy Johnson's comments reflected my own conflict with the corporate staff in New York. Whenever I wanted to hire a key person, corporate would serve up their slate of candidates for the corporate dotted line positions in finance, human resources, and legal. In those functions, I had to fight for every person I wanted to hire. I didn't always get to pick the ones I wanted. On several occasions, I had to settle for someone on the corporate slate. A couple of finance managers I was forced to take weren't even close to capable, and I eventually had to remove them. A big fight I lost was the time I tried to promote a young lawyer, Bob Wright, as general counsel for the plastics business. I thought he was a lot more than a lawyer. Bob was 27 years old and had just come from private practice. When I was promoted to the division job, I brought Art Puccini with me as general counsel. Bob was the perfect candidate to succeed Art in the plastics business. GE's general counsel had a different view. He felt that Bob's age and experience made him unqualified, so he stuffed me with a slate of his cronies. I took one of them. I solved the problem of promoting Bob Wright by asking him to take on strategy development for plastics in 1973. I could fill that position without corporate interference. Although it was an unlikely job for a lawyer, Bob was sensational in it. He had a million ideas and brought new life to the position. In 18 months, we made him the national sales manager for plastics. His quick wit and extroverted personality made him a natural fit for the job and gave him experience he would use forever. Bob eventually became president of NBC. Today, he is a vice chairman of GE, a long road from being a corporate reject for the legal job in a business doing less than $100 million a year in sales. Tension between the headquarters and the field is common in every organization. In Bob Wright's case, I found a way to beat the system without openly defying it. For the past 20 years, I hoped every day that GE people were making the case for the people they wanted, even if my staff and I were trying to stuff our own candidates down their throats. While the bureaucracy often frustrated me, I tried hard not to be a very visible critic of it, especially not to the higher-ups. By the early 1970s, I had started to think about the possibility of running GE. I actually said it in 1973 when I presumptuously wrote in my performance review that my long-range career objective was to become CEO. I was determined not to blow my dream by tilting at windmills. If I bitched and moaned about the system would get me. I was fortunate. The system bent. The company gave me an incredible number of different experiences. For the most part, it let me be myself. Chapter 5, Getting Closer to the Big Leagues. During June of 1973, I got my next big break. Reuben Guthoff was promoted to head of strategic planning for the entire company, and I got his job as group executive. The promotion meant that I had to move to corporate headquarters. Besides the chemical and metallurgical division I already managed from Pittsfield, I was now responsible for a number of other businesses: medical systems in Milwaukee, appliance components in Fort Wayne, electronic components in Syracuse. It was a diverse portfolio of products with over $2 billion in annual sales. The group employed 46,000 people and had 44 factories in the United States, plus operations in Belgium, Ireland, Italy, Japan, the Netherlands, Singapore, and Turkey. The promotion was a big deal. Only 16 months earlier, I was named a GE vice president at the age of 36. This new job put me on the radar screen. I was becoming a real player. I went to the New York headquarters to look at sample offices that had been set up similar to those in the company's planned new offices in Fairfield. GE would move there in August 1974. I picked out the furniture from my office with a set number of ceiling tiles signifying one's status in the corporation. There was only one problem, a very big one. I didn't want to move to the new headquarters in Fairfield. Over the 13 years I had lived in Pittsfield, I had constructed the ideal life for my family and me. I loved the Berkshires. From our cramped apartment in 1960, Carolyn and I had moved into a succession of homes until we owned what I thought was one of the best houses in town. We had a network of good friends. Our four children were still young and in local public schools. Pittsfield was a great place to bring up kids, with mountains and lakes just minutes away. I had a spectacular group of friends at the Pittsfield Country Club, where we played life-and-death games of golf and paddle tennis. I played hockey in a town pickup league well into my 30s. I knew just about everybody. I really felt like the big fish in a little pond. I didn't want to give it up. Pittsfield had another advantage. It kept me out of the rat race at headquarters. I flew to New York that summer to see Herm Weiss, then a vice chairman. As a group executive, I would report to Herm. He was a large and imposing man, tall with broad shoulders. An unassuming guy, Herm had been a star college athlete in football and baseball, and was honored by Sports Illustrated as one of its Silver Anniversary Award winners. I really liked him. We both loved golf, wisecracking, and betting on Sunday football games. First a boss, then an ally and friend, Herm took me under his wing. It seemed everywhere I went, I found a mentor. I wasn't searching for a surrogate father, but good people always seemed to crop up and give me their support. I usually looked forward to every meeting with Herm. This time, I arrived in his office scared stiff. I went there to ask him to let me stay in Pittsfield. I argued that most of my time would be spent in the field with the businesses. I promised I would never be late for the monthly meetings at headquarters. In a moment of weakness or charity or both, Herm finally said yes. I practically jumped up and kissed him. I got out of his office in a hurry before he could change his mind or report his decision to Reg, who I was sure wanted me at headquarters. When Reg found out, he couldn't believe Herm had let me stay in the field. I moved out of my old office on Plastics Avenue and set up shop with a 5-person staff in a suite of offices on the second floor of the Berkshire Hilton in Pittsfield. Over the next 5 years, I kept my promise to Herm never to miss a meeting. When Pittsfield's weather threatened to close down the airport, I would go down the night before. If we got a weather surprise, I'd jump in the car at 5 a.m. and drive like a maniac to New York in time for the start of a business review. This group executive job was my best to date. The new $2 billion business mix gave me a large playpen to practice what I had learned. The chemical and metallurgical division, which included plastics, was growing. The appliance components business was a set of motors and widgets with good profits, but half of the sales were internal to GE. The electronic components business was a real mixed bag, from semiconductors to TV tubes and capacitors. Several of these electronic products were doing well, while others just bled red ink. The medical business, selling primarily X-ray equipment, had great potential, but in 1973 was losing money. This new job gave me the chance to put together a new team. I found a staff of bright, savvy, street-smart people with complementary skills in finance, human resources, strategy, and law. After being stuffed for years by corporate with candidates who were less than the best, I was lucky to finally get two strong GE executives from the system, Tom Thorson and Ralph Hubrickson. Tom, my finance guy, was exceptionally smart, handsome, tough, and fun-loving. Ralph, my human resources person, was an unmade bed. Craggy-faced, he smoked cigars until their very end, scattering ashes everywhere. He was an administrative nightmare, often staying up all night long to finish the books for our presentations at headquarters. But you couldn't find anyone with a better nose for people. I went outside for my strategic planner and found Greg Lamont from Booz Allen and Hamilton. He was the first of many smart people I hired from the consulting industry, which was ironic because I disliked consulting. Greg lived far outside the box, always challenging conventional thinking. Last, I again promoted Art Puccini, my former general counsel, to the top legal job in the group. Born in Brooklyn with degrees in pharmacy and law, Art had joined GE just a few years before. He brought a good mix of smarts and street savvy. You couldn't have found a more diverse band of characters, some GE insiders and a pair from the outside world. All of us were earthy, without pretense or formality, always blunt. Along with half a dozen support staff, we moved into a 3,600-square-foot group office suite at the Hilton. Without a corporate boss in sight, we wore sweaters and jeans to work. We shouted back and forth through the open doors. The place had the feel of a college dorm. On Friday nights, we'd often go to the hotel's rooftop lounge to rehash the week over a few beers. We'd get up there about 6:30 p.m., and our wives would show up 2 hours later. By then, we had nearly exhausted all our exaggerated tales from the week. Listening to our war stories wasn't the biggest treat for any of them, but they were great sports. They liked one another as much as we did. Often, we'd get together on the weekends for Saturday night dinner or Sunday afternoon parties, many times with our kids. We were having the time of our lives and getting paid for it. We spent most of our time in the field doing people and strategy reviews. We chartered a Citation jet that got us around easily. I was so excited to have a plane. Carolyn saw it another way. "Jack, you're such a fool," she said. "They let you have the plane so you can work yourself to death." She had a point, but I loved it anyway. Often, we'd leave on a Monday morning and wouldn't return until Friday night. We'd visit Fort Wayne, Indiana, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Columbus, Ohio, as if they were towns next door. I'm sure some of the managers must have thought, damn, here they come again. We'd spend hours locked in a room, peeling back the onion until all the issues were exposed. While some enjoyed the sessions and called them great intellectual combat, I'm sure others looked forward to them like they would to a root canal. We had the best of both worlds. We had the resources of a big company, but with the same family atmosphere of my earlier years in the plastics business. Trying to oversee these diverse businesses in remote locations, I realized, more than ever before, how much my success would depend on the people I hired. From my first days in plastics, I understood the importance of getting the right people. It was clear that when I found someone great, it made all the difference in the world. I learned a lot of this the hard way by making some big mistakes. The inconsistency of my first hires was laughable. One of my most common errors was to hire on appearances. In marketing, I'd sometimes recruit good-looking, slick-talking packages. Some of those were good, and some were just empty suits. I made other beauties. I was 30 when I began hiring in Asia. Obviously, I couldn't speak Japanese. I had little feel for the culture, so I did the obvious. If a Japanese candidate spoke English well, I usually hired him. It took me a while to find out that using language as a hiring screen was a marginal idea at best. Many of my hiring mistakes reflected my own silly prejudices, probably because I went to UMass, a former agricultural school that was just emerging in engineering. Academic pedigrees impressed me. For engineering talent, I'd try to hire MIT, Princeton, and Caltech graduates. I should have reminded myself where I had come from. Often, I found out that where they came from wouldn't determine how good they'd be. In the early days, I fell in love with great resumes filled with degrees in different disciplines. They could be bright and intellectually curious, but they often turned out to be unfocused dabblers, unwilling to commit, lacking intensity and passion for any one thing. In the hands of the inexperienced, resumes are dangerous weapons. Eventually, I learned that I was really looking for people who were filled with passion and a desire to get things done. A resume didn't tell me much about that inner hunger. I had to feel it. In this new group job, I discovered that the only business I would ever know in my blood was plastics. This was a big transition in my thinking. I could no longer have fingertip control of all the details. That made my obsession about people even more intense. My HR partner, Ralph Hubrickson, and I began going out to the businesses, spending a full day in a room first with the general manager and his HR executive team, and then with all his direct reports. After 10 or 12 hours of heated discussion, I'd come away with a pretty good sense of the talent we had at the top two or three levels of the business. The reaction was total shock. No one was used to these intense personal discussions about the strengths and weaknesses of every individual on their team. The leaders in the field who bore the brunt of these exchanges were the four divisional vice presidents who reported to me: Julian Charlier in medical, Walt Robb in chemical and metallurgical, George Farnsworth in electronic components, Fred Holt in appliance components. Farnsworth was a real savvy GE insider who was truly his own man. He flew open cockpit planes, was cynical yet funny, and was someone I got to like very much. Holt was another wise GE veteran. He played every corporate game there was and had been doing so for years. More often than not, he pretty much got what he wanted. Fred was probably 20 years older than me and had seen and heard it all. He saw me like a stomachache that would soon pass. George and Fred were the first two mainstream GE corporate officers I ever managed. They often thought I was off the wall, but seemed to respect my enthusiasm, if nothing else. Fred clearly was in his final job, and George was not obsessed with career advancement, although he would later get a big promotion to run our aerospace business. Charlier, a Belgian who came from a small medical acquisition team in Liège, Belgium, now ran the medical business. I had watched him for a couple of years when we both reported to Gutoff. Charlier was a urbane European who had a grandiose idea every minute but wasn't much into following up on them. He had built a beautiful new headquarters building for medical outside Milwaukee that gave the business new panache. There was a part of his bon vivant and creativity that I liked, but his inability to deliver results, which had bothered me as a peer, really drove me nuts when he began reporting to me. I tried to stay with Charlier because I enjoyed him, but his 50,000-foot-high view of everything didn't work. We had several discussions about this and the lousy performance of the business until we finally decided that he would be better back in Europe at another company. To replace him, I made a phone call on a Sunday night to Walt Robb. During my early days in plastics, he often called me on Sunday nights offering support, gossip, and advice. This time, I made the Sunday phone call to Walt and asked him to take over the medical business. My offer damn near knocked him on the floor. "You love technology and you're curious," I said. "You're the perfect guy to run the medical business." Walt thought I was crazy. In 20 months, he had gone from being head of a small $7.5 million medical development business to manager of the chemical and metallurgical division, one of GE's biggest and most profitable businesses, with $500 million in sales. He had been in that job only 4 months and liked it. Now I was asking him to take over our medical business with half the revenue, and it was losing money. Walt had trouble seeing my offer to run an unprofitable business making X-ray equipment, pacemakers, and heart monitors in the middle of Wisconsin as the opportunity of a lifetime. He took the job, intrigued by the technology and some of my own BS. Walt inherited a business that primarily sold X-ray equipment to both radiologists and dentists. Shortly after Walt got there, EMI, the English electronics company, now the music company, had a major breakthrough, the CT, computed tomography scanner. The advance posed a major threat to our existing X-ray business, but it was a huge challenge and really got our competitive juices flowing. Walt, who had gotten his start at GE's research lab, went right back to his scientist friends in Schenectady for help. It was easy to excite the lab about the opportunity, since the EMI invention had captured the attention of the scientific world. My only contribution was to follow the team's progress weekly, serving at times as a cattle prod and on other occasions a cheerleader. About 80 people worked round the clock to create a product that would give us faster and better images than the EMI model. Everything about this had startup written over it. Researchers practically lived in the lab, eating out of pizza boxes, and we made our first scanners out of a rented grocery store in Milwaukee. By early 1976, they were taking orders for the $650,000 machine. Once again, I saw the benefits of acting like a small company. Giving the project visibility, putting great people on it, and giving them plenty of money continues to be the best formula for success. The CT changed the medical business forever. An unprofitable operation with $215 million in sales when Walt took it over was in 2000 one of GE's jewels, with operating profit of $1.7 billion on over $7 billion of sales. I broke up the chemical and metallurgical division that Walt had been running and spun out the high-growth plastics business. I put Chuck Carson, who had run our laminates business, over the slower-growing but highly profitable remaining materials business. The plastics business posed something of a dilemma. My friend Tom Fitzgerald was now running silicones and was the obvious internal choice for the plastics job, but he was my closest business friend, and as a result, I saw both his strengths and his weaknesses more than anyone else. I decided to compare Tom with the best I could find on the outside. I've said that I've made my share of hiring mistakes. None would be bigger than the one I was about to make. I passed over Tom for the job and brought in an outsider who had once run GE's silicone operations. As a young manager in the plastics business in the early 1960s, I was blown away by the presentations he gave at division-wide meetings. He was the most articulate of all the leadership. His speaking skills were particularly impressive to me because I couldn't deliver a speech to save my life. Before reading my first speech in front of a few hundred GE executives in Cooperstown, New York, I twice had to leave the front row of the auditorium to run to the bathroom. I was really pleased with myself for enticing him back. He seemed the perfect package. Well-dressed, articulate, someone who made a great first impression. He had left GE for a bigger opportunity in the chemical industry, which only impressed me more. Bringing him back as a corporate vice president was a big deal. To do this, I had to get approval from our corporate human resources people in Fairfield, as well as from Herm and Reg. It didn't take very long to realize that my new man wasn't up to the job. I had hired someone from an image I'd had 15 years ago. I knew I had to make a change. It was a real dilemma. I thought I was a candidate in the succession race for Reg's job. By hiring this outsider, I had gone against Roy Johnson, the HR head, who always favored the inside candidates. This could have been a disaster for me. Within 6 months, I had to go to headquarters and tell Roy Johnson, Herm Weiss, and Reg Jones that I had screwed up and needed to remove him. Talk about a tough day. I had gone against the system. I hadn't hired one of my friends who expected and in retrospect deserved the promotion. I was embarrassed for the person I had recruited because it was so obvious this was the wrong job for him. Herm's reaction was supportive. You made a mistake. I'm glad you moved fast to correct it. Reg simply said, okay, but was otherwise guarded with his thoughts. Johnson used it as another example of my immaturity. Holt and Farnsworth were not only good guys, they were savvy, and they knew how the GE system worked. This was my first real look inside the traditional GE. Their insights opened my eyes to this other world. There are 1,000 Holt stories, but the one I like best involves people evaluations. In Fort Wayne one day, during an HR review, Fred was giving a glowing appraisal of a guy I knew. Fred, how the hell could you write this? He's not that good. We both know this guy is a turkey. This appraisal is ridiculous. To my surprise, Fred agreed. Do you want to see the real one? He asked. I can't send this to headquarters. They'd want me to kill this guy. Fred wasn't alone in those days. He thought he was being a nice guy, protecting people who weren't up to their jobs. That's just the way it was. No one wanted to deliver bad news. In those days, it was standard to fill out your appraisal form by writing that your career objective was at least your boss's job. The boss's response usually was fully qualified to assume next position, even if they both knew it wasn't true. Many of these kind performance appraisals would come back to haunt me in the early 1980s when we had to downsize the company. That false kindness only misled people and made their layoff an even greater shock than it should have been. From George Farnsworth and his electronic components business, I got 2 things. One was my first hard look at semiconductors, a business I disliked immediately. Yes, it had high growth, but it was too cyclical for me and ate up enormous amounts of capital. It took me close to a decade to get out of it. The other thing I got from George would stay with me for the next 25 years. The controversy over PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls. George managed the capacitor business in Hudson Falls, New York, which used PCBs as electrical insulators. It was my first experience dealing with the government. From 1971 to 1977, my responsibility broadened continually, from running a $100 million business to a $400 million division and soon a $2 billion group. I learned the importance of people, supporting the best and removing the weakest. I learned to support high-growth businesses like medical and plastics and how to squeeze everything out of slow-growth operations. It was a great set of experiences. Toward the end of 1977, I got a phone call in Pittsfield. It was from Reg in Fairfield. He wanted to see me, and it was urgent. I was there the next morning. I think highly of you, Reg said, but Jack, you don't understand General Electric. You've only seen 10% of the company. GE's a lot more than that. I have a new job for you. Sector executive for the consumer products businesses. But Jack, this job is in Fairfield. You can't be a big fish in a small pond anymore. If you want to be considered for bigger things, you're going to have to come here. I was thrilled to get another promotion, even if it meant that I would finally have to leave Pittsfield. Carolyn was eager to move on. She was looking forward to a fresh start and a new place, and felt the move would help our 4 kids grow. By now, 2 of our 4 kids, Kathy and John, were in high school. Anne was in the 9th grade, and Mark was in the 5th. Despite my crazy work habits, we were a close family. We always took a week off to ski in the winter during spring break, and never missed renting a house in the Cape for a 2-week vacation in the summer. I admit I had a tough time taking a complete vacation from the job. When we were on the Cape, I'd often sneak off the beach to a payphone to check into the office a couple of times a day. When we skied, I'd pop into the lodge to do the same. Nonetheless, these vacations gave us lots of time to hang out together. We spent hours playing board games and sports. I'd tried to put as much fun and competition as possible into the games by egging all of them on. When we returned home, I always made up wooden plaques for the best sport, best miniature golfer, or best crypto player, and handed them out to the kids. I guess I was trying to duplicate my mother's gin rummy games. Some of my kids were like me. They didn't take losing all that well. Like most teenagers, they weren't excited to pick up and leave. Things had been good for them there. They all did well in school, and they had plenty of friends. But it wasn't always easy for them. One morning, my son John was sitting on the school bus when it stopped to make its next pickup. A classmate climbed aboard and went straight at John, taking an unexpected swing at him. The fight broke up quickly, but poor John, then not much more than 8 or 9 years old, had no idea why it happened. It wasn't until he told the story at the dinner table that night that I explained that I had asked the boy's dad to leave GE. We all felt awful for John, especially me, who still remembers that story as if it occurred yesterday. Excited as I was about the new job, I was as sad as the kids about leaving Pittsfield. To keep a tie to the place, just before moving out, I bought 5 acres of inexpensive land on a mountaintop in nearby Lenox. In fact, the day we left town with our Buick station wagon packed to the gills with our 4 kids in the back, we stopped off at the real estate agent's office to complete the purchase. For some reason, it made me feel better. My promotion to Fairfield brought me to a new organizational layer as a sector executive. There was a hierarchy at GE, like any other large company, and I had been lucky to climb through it. Sometimes it felt like the civil service, with all its 29 levels and dozens of titles and promotions, from a lab to a unit to a subsection to a section to a department, then a division and a group. The sector jobs were rated level 27, just 2 small steps from the 29th level attached to Reg's own job. This was a big move. It put me in the race for Reg's job. I was excited by the possibilities, but apprehensive about whether the Pittsfield Act would play in the Fairfield bureaucracy. Chapter 6, Swimming in a Bigger Pond. Early one December morning in 1977, I drove past the security guard at the front gate of GE's headquarters in Fairfield and up the winding driveway. All the trees were bare and the grounds were covered with snow that day. I turned into the concrete underground garage, parked my car in an empty slot, got in the elevator, and went to the 3rd floor of the West Building. I walked down the wide hallway to a corner office with a glass door, the farthest office away from Chairman Reg Jones. The place was very quiet and formal, cold and unwelcoming. I had no secretary and no staff other than 3 managers who had worked for one of my chief rivals for Reg's job. I didn't know many of the hundreds of people who worked in Fairfield headquarters. Reuben Gutoff, the man who had once convinced me to stay at GE, had himself left the company 2 years earlier, in late 1975. There were only a couple of friendly and familiar faces. Charlie Reed, the executive who had been so supportive when I blew up the Pittsfield plant, was now in Fairfield as the company's chief technologist. Mike Allen, a former McKinsey & Company consultant, whom I had first met in my plastics days, had moved to headquarters to work in strategic planning. Both men were far away from my office and busy with other things. What really made me feel alone was the loss of my good friend and supporter in Fairfield. Herm Weiss, one of GE's vice chairmen, had died a year earlier from lung cancer. He had been my only real link to the top brass of the corporation. In a final show of support, Herm walked 3 holes with me during the board of directors' July golf outing. 6 weeks later, in September 1976, he died at New York Hospital. I subsequently discovered that in his final days he had told Reg to keep his eye on me because I was the person who was going places. Talk about lonely. Forget about all that small fish in big pond stuff. I felt like a minnow in an ocean. Of course, I had been here many times doing various dog and pony routines. Even then, by the end of the day, after presenting a business plan or asking for the cash to build a new plant, I was always happy to return to Pittsfield. This time, of course, it would be different. This was permanent. What a difference from going to the office every day in a sweater and blue jeans working with five of my close friends. By hiring people who became my friends and actively socializing with them and their families, I had probably broken the rules of corporate behavior. But we got the job done, and we enjoyed doing it. We felt like a family instead of a business. Now all that was gone. To add to my out-there feeling, for the next 4 months I lived out of a suitcase at the Stamford Marriott until Carolyn and our four kids could move to our new home in Connecticut. There was one positive side effect. It allowed me to bury myself in my new job. The move to Fairfield came with a big promotion to a newly created layer of management. I was now one of five sector executives who had all been publicly identified as candidates in a horse race for Reg's job, along with two corporate staffers, Al Way, GE's chief financial officer, and Bob Frederick, the senior vice president for corporate planning. The four other sector heads were John Burlingame, a physicist who ran GE's international businesses, Ed Hood, a nuclear engineer who ran the technical products and services sector, Stan Galt, a longtime veteran of the appliance business who had the industrial sector, and finally, Tom Vanderslice, a former Fulbright scholar who ran power systems. Reg put in this new layer as part of his succession process to test our skills and abilities in running multi-billion-dollar portfolios that we weren't familiar with. I drew consumer products and services, the only existing sector that had been created a year earlier by Reg to try out the idea. The job put me in charge of a group of businesses with $4.2 billion in revenues, about 20% of the company's total sales. The businesses included major appliances, air conditioners, lighting products, housewares, and audio products, television receivers, radio and TV stations, and GE Credit Corporation. The structure was a great idea to help Reg choose his successor, but there was one problem for me. My new direct boss, Vice Chairman Walter Dave Dance, favored another candidate in the race, his longtime protege, Stan Galt, who, like Dance, had invested virtually his entire career in our appliance businesses. Dance's support for Galt was obvious and visible. He was certainly entitled to his opinion, but it made my life difficult. It was the first time in my 17 years at GE that I had a boss who was not rooting for me. Nor did it help that Galt had run my sector the previous year. So I was in a position where every move I made could appear to second-guess him or Dance. The other vice chairman, Jack Parker, also had his favorites in the race. I was not one of them. Parker was one of the aircraft engineer pioneers at GE who always supported that business and the people in it. He favored his two direct reports, Burlingame and Hood. This left Tom Vanderslice and me as the odd men out. What gave me hope was that the two vice chairmen, Dance and Parker, didn't have much of a relationship with each other or with Reg, who hadn't chosen them in the first place. Reg had inherited both vice chairmen from his predecessor. Both had been rivals for the job. They weren't bad guys, but they were disappointed that they didn't get Reg's job. There is probably nothing worse in business than to work for a boss who doesn't want you to win. This can happen anywhere, at any level, and probably occurs more often than we think. Until I came to work for Dance, I had never had it happen to me. I survived the experience only by doing what I thought was right. I trusted Reg and the system to be fair. Had it been a forever assignment, I would have dumped it. I wouldn't have ruined my career or my sanity by sticking around. In my case, it was easier than it might be for others. I knew what I wanted, and it wasn't going to take long to find out if I was going to get it. From day one, the succession process was thick with politics. You could feel the tension in the building every day. The five sector heads were all located in what was known as the West Building of the two-building Fairfield complex. Each of us had a corner office, a conference room, and space for several support staff. Whenever we were in town, we'd usually end up in an uncomfortable situation in the corporate dining room for lunch, We'd munch on sandwiches, always being careful about what we said. It was awful. The field became my refuge from the politics. Fortunately, to do the job right, I needed to spend as little time in Fairfield as possible. The team behind me was talented and mobile. David Orsolet, my human resources executive, had a perfect nose for sniffing out talent and was someone everyone trusted, a priceless trait in an HR person. I didn't know it at the time, but Dave's support of me in the final selection would be very important. Dick Schlegel, a warm man and very savvy finance guy, was also in place. Dick helped me find two people who would play critical roles in my career: Dennis Dammerman from GE Credit and Bob Nelson, a financial analyst who had spent years in appliances. Dennis grew up on a farm in Grand Mound, Iowa. As a kid, he was lifted and dumped into burlap bags so he could tamp down the newly shorn wool from the family's herd of sheep. As a teen, he began working for another electric company, as an electrician's apprentice at his father's company, Dammerman Electric, everything electrical. After graduating from the University of Dubuque in 1967, Dennis found himself visiting friends in Bloomington, Illinois, where a GE factory made electrical parts. He approached the security guard at the plant's gate and asked about a job. Luckily, he was referred to a manager inside who hired Dennis for GE's financial management program. He was brilliant, tough, and as dependable a person as anyone could ever count on. Dennis had enormous capacity and loved to take on any difficult assignment. Bob Nelson was the intellectual in the crowd. A graduate of Carleton College, he is a political science and history buff with a fabulous analytical mind. Bob seemed headed for a life as a college professor. He got a master's degree in general studies and humanities at the University of Chicago and began work on a Ph.D. in American Studies. He took a detour into business, joining GE's financial management program in 1966. Together, Dennis and Bob would become my financial tutors, and I would rely on their good judgments until the day I retired from GE. Dennis would become my chief financial officer, CEO of GE Capital Services, and a vice chairman of the company. Bob would become vice president for financial analysis. I also brought in a friend from Pittsfield, Norm Blake, as my manager of business development. Norm was a bright, tenacious, and hyperactive entrepreneur who had held the same job with me in plastics. He would become an executive vice president at GE Capital, and in 1984 left the company to become chairman of Heller International. I went after this new job just as I always had in Pittsfield. Only now we'd fly out from Fairfield to get to know the new businesses and the people in them. We'd typically start a review at 7:30 a.m. and then spend hours peeling back the onion again. Rarely would we finish before 8 or 9 at night, when we'd go out to dinner together to review the day's session and size up the talent in each business. Because of the lack of support from my boss, I went at my job as if he weren't there. The most difficult issues to deal with would be in the appliance business. Changes in direction could be perceived as shots at my predecessors, Dance and Galt. They had run the appliance operations for more than a decade. For years, it had been a sweetheart business of GE. Dance and Galt had plans for massive expansion of our appliance park in Louisville, Kentucky. They had started by building an appliance park east in Columbia, Maryland, and there was talk of an appliance park west in Salt Lake City, Utah. Their ambitious plans reflected the company's conventional view of the business's potential. It had been driven by the glow of the post-war era, when a rising middle class filled its new kitchens with new appliances. There was no question that the business would continue to grow. The real questions, however, were how fast that growth would be and how well positioned we were against our major U.S. and global competitors. My new associates, Bob Nelson and Dennis Dammerman, who had both spent time in the appliance business, tore apart the numbers and the conventional assumptions. Our look said that growth would slow. The big expansion plans needed to be re-examined. In fairness, I think Dance and Galt were coming to the same conclusion. Even more important than the expansion was our situation in Louisville. We had to improve it. While sales and profits were okay, productivity was steadily declining. For years, headquarters had been hearing a fairly optimistic view of appliances. In Louisville, an army of economists, strategic planners, and finance people were believers in and advocates for the business. They didn't want to admit that the days of post-war growth were rapidly changing. They weren't alone. Their expansive view was shared by much of American industry. In Louisville, the leadership team in appliances had moved out of our manufacturing and engineering center to an office suite on the top floor of a